VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
in the United States, many people are deciding to rent instead of owning a home. As a result, young people face one of the most competitive rental markets in the past 10 years. People under the age of 24, known as Generation Z, are competing with older generations. Many millennials, people aged 24 to 40, and baby boomers, those over 57, are looking for apartments too. People are choosing to rent for different reasons. One expert talked with VOA and said a lack of available houses is one big reason. Doug Ressler is with Yardie Matrix, a research company that deals with business properties. He said that aging millennials who are starting families should be moving from rentals to home ownership. But in many cases, they are not because of the lack of available houses. And so, he said, these older millennials continue to rent. It is not just millennials or Generation Z, Ressler added. The number of baby boomers moving into rental properties has been growing in the last 5 years. There are other reasons older people are choosing to rent instead of owning. They've lived in a home for so long, and they want to be able to reduce their expenses on a fixed income, Ressler told VOA. Another housing expert describes the rental market as hot, meaning very competitive. It's a hot market. We have never seen this market so hot in the last decade, said Gay Cororton. She is Director of Housing and Commercial Research at the National Association of Realtors. She said, the average rent growth year over year is about 3 to 5%. We're seeing 11% rent growth now. And many large cities around the world, people say they are facing a housing shortage that is affecting both rental properties and available homes. In September, Bloomberg reported about rising rent payments in major cities. People in Australia, Canada, Germany, Ireland, Argentina, and South Korea said it was harder to afford apartments in city centers. High rental costs make it more difficult to save for a house. Another influence on the current housing situation has been the COVID-19 pandemic. It has caused problems for the building industry. Supplies of building materials have decreased while costs have gone up. In the U.S., this slowed down home building. It also meant that the supply of available homes had dropped well below normal levels by January of this year. The lack of housing supply means millennials are having a harder time finding and buying single-family homes. Traditionally, millennials are at the right age for home ownership. Cororton said the supply of available houses shrank during the pandemic as more investors put their money into housing. She added that some homeowners also looked for second homes during the pandemic. With the pandemic, there was also a big demand for second homes, for vacation homes. Typically, vacation homes accounted for just about 5% of the market, she said. Early this summer, they rose to about 8%. Strong demand and strong imbalance of demand and supply caused home prices to rise, she noted. Kororatan expects conditions to improve in the coming year, but says the housing shortage is likely to continue for the next few years.
Electric vehicles, or EVs, are a strong weapon in the world's efforts against global warming. But the effects of EVs depend on what country you are in. In some nations, electric vehicles lead to the release of more carbon gases than gasoline cars, new research shows. The Radiant Energy Group, REG, compared gas emissions caused by a gasoline vehicle and from charging an electric vehicle. The study compared the emissions caused by charging a Tesla Model 3 to drive 100 kilometers with the emissions coming from an average gasoline car driven the same distance. Countries where charging an electric vehicle is cleaner than driving a gasoline-powered car use a lot of hydroelectric, nuclear, or solar power. Sales of electric cars are rising the fastest in Europe. Data from REG suggests that EVs in Poland and Kosovo actually create more carbon emissions because their electric systems depend so much on coal. In other European countries, however, EVs result in reduced emissions. The carbon gas reduction depends on what energy supplies electricity systems and the time of day vehicles are charged. The countries with the biggest carbon gas savings from EVs use a lot of nuclear and hydroelectric power. First was Switzerland at 100% carbon savings over gasoline vehicles. Next was Norway at 98%, France at 96%, Sweden at 95%, and Austria 93%. The research was based on public data on Europe's electricity usage and the European Environment Agency, or EEA. The countries which showed the lowest savings were Cyprus at 4%, Serbia 15%, Estonia 35%, and the Netherlands 37%. An EV driver in Germany reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 55% over a gasoline car. Germany uses a mix of renewable energy and coal to produce electricity. Germany and Spain create a lot of electricity from the sun and wind. But the sun and wind do not add to a country's electricity system equally throughout the day. For this reason, the amount of carbon emissions saved by driving an EV depends on the time of day it is being charged. Charging in the afternoon, when there is more sun and wind, saves 16 to 18% more carbon than at night, when electricity systems are more likely to be using gas or coal. The study was released just before Wednesday's talks on transportation at the United Nations climate meeting in Glasgow. During the meeting, a group of countries, companies, and cities promised to stop making gas-powered cars by 2040. But the study showed how the auto industry's ability to reduce emissions depends on what national power systems use to produce electricity. European countries have not solved how to reduce carbon emissions and how to store some kinds of renewable energy in their systems. The gap in emissions between electric and gasoline-powered vehicles has narrowed in recent years. In Europe, car makers have been required to meet EU carbon reduction standards. They have made their gasoline engines more fuel efficient. As a result, the carbon emissions of new gasoline-powered cars in Europe fell an average of 25% between 2006 and 2016, EEA information says. EV sales in Europe are supported by government spending and rules against new gasoline engine cars after 2035. About 1 in 5 cars sold in Europe from July to September of this year were electric. Automakers including General Motors, Stellantis, and Volkswagen have set targets to sell mainly electric vehicles in Europe in the coming years. U.S. car manufacturer General Motors said it will have all new electric cars by 2022. I'm Dan Novak.
A new technology project in southern Greece is helping visitors experience the ancient birthplace of the Olympic Games. The project used augmented reality to recreate temples and competition areas in the ancient city of Olympia. It was recently launched in the city, one of the world's major archaeological sites. Augmented reality, or AR, is a technology that can project computer-created imagery onto special eyeglasses. Through the eyeglasses, the images appear along with other physical objects in the environment. The project is a partnership between American software maker Microsoft and Greece's Ministry of Culture and Sport. The ministry helped Microsoft map and build virtual representations of Olympia. The city was used for nearly 1,000 years to host the games in ancient Greece that served as the model for the modern Olympics. It's a milestone that helped us bring technology and culture and history together so we can preserve it, Microsoft President Brad Smith said in a video message at the launch event. The experience provides users the chance to virtually walk through the ruins of Olympia. At the Olympic Museum in Athens, people can also use Microsoft's AR headsets for a similar experience. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis joined a group of schoolchildren who were using the app for the first time. "I'm absolutely thrilled that we're able to present to the world a completely new cultural experience using technology to recreate the ancient world of Olympia," Mitsotakis told the Associated Press. Students from a local middle school looked at statues and structures that were brought to life on their phones. they were able to virtually visit inside and outside settings to explore where ancient Olympians had competed in different sports. One of the children, Panagiotis Christopoulos, called the project impressive. "I think it can help with teaching in schools," the student said. The project began 18 months ago with a series of imaging flights to help map areas across Olympia. Microsoft is to build several data centers in and near Athens as part of a $1 billion investment agreement with the Greek government. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By 1863, America's northern states and southern states had been fighting a bitter civil war for 2 years. Both sides felt the pressure of the costly struggle. The South was beginning to suffer from a lack of supplies and men for its armies. The North was beginning to suffer from a lack of fighting spirit. Larry West and Tony Riggs describe an anti-war movement that was growing.
Many Americans in northern states did not support the war policies of Union President Abraham Lincoln. Some said openly that they did not care who won the war. They just wanted to be left alone. Coal miners in Pennsylvania protested against a law drafting men into the Union Army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to Pennsylvania to put down the riots. Farmers in Ohio also protested. They refused to be drafted. They attacked soldiers who were sent to arrest them. The worst anti-war riots, however, took place in New York City.
On July 13th, 1863, a crowd formed outside a New York draft office. Inside, Army officials were choosing the names of men who would be taken into the Army. Each name was written on a separate piece of paper. The papers were mixed together in a big box. The officials then began to remove the papers, one at a time. They made a list of the names. These were the men of New York who must go off to fight. On that day, however, the list was never completed. The crowd outside the draft office became louder. There were shouts of protest against the draft and against the Civil War.
Suddenly, a stone crashed through the office window, then another, and another. The army officials escaped, but a policeman inside could not get away. The rioters beat him badly. Then they set fire to the draft office and several buildings nearby. The riot spread across the city. The riot began as a political protest against the draft. Poor men opposed the draft because it permitted rich men to escape military service. The law said a man who was drafted could stay out of the army by doing one of two things. He could pay the government $300, or he could pay another man to serve in his place. If a drafted man could not do either thing, then he must join the army or be shot as a deserter.
In the wartime economy of the North, prices were rising much faster than wages. Even a man with a good job had a difficult time feeding his family. It was impossible for him to pay the government $300 or pay someone else to serve for him in the army. Poor men protested against the law. They said it was unfair. "It's a rich man's war," they cried, "but a poor man's fight. The rich man's money against the poor man's blood."
There was something else that deeply troubled working men in the North. Anti-war activists told them that the war was not being fought to save the Union, but to free Negro slaves. The activists said the freed Negroes would move north and take jobs away from whites. Many men believed this. They said they would not fight.
Then, on July 13th, the angers and fears of working men in New York exploded. Their attack on the draft office that day was just the beginning. The violence lasted 3 days. The rioters beat many policemen to death. They beat, burned, and hanged every Negro they could find. They also killed many whites who tried to protect the Negroes. By the time soldiers stopped the rioting, 1,000 persons had been killed.
The leaders of the anti-war movement in the North were members of the opposition Democratic Party. They wore on their coats a copper penny showing the head of a Native American Indian. This gave them the name Copperheads. One important Copperhead was a former congressman from Ohio, Clement Vallandigham. Vallandigham made a speech criticizing the Union government. He was charged with violating a military law that banned such criticism. He was arrested.
The former congressman was taken before a military court. He objected. He said if he had broken a law, he should be tried by a civilian court. He demanded this as his constitutional right. The military judges rejected his argument. They found him guilty, and they sentenced him to remain in a Union military prison until the end of the war. People throughout the North were angry. Many did not support Clement Vallandigham's ideas, but they supported his right to speak freely. President Lincoln could approve or reject Vallandigham's sentence. His decision would show which issue was more important, the citizen's right to free speech or national security.
Lincoln was a good politician and a smart lawyer. He found an unexpected way to deal with the problem. He neither approved nor rejected the sentence. He changed it. Lincoln ordered Vallandigham to be turned over to the Confederate Army. Then he explained that Vallandigham had not been arrested for criticizing the government. His arrest was made, Lincoln said, because he was trying, with some success, to prevent men from entering the army. He was urging soldiers already in the army to leave it. Mr. Vallandigham was not arrested because he was damaging the political chances of the administration or the interests of the commanding general, but because he was damaging the army, upon which the life of the nation depends. The Confederates welcomed the anti-war leader. They helped him get to Canada. Vallandigham continued his anti-war campaign from there.
President Lincoln was troubled by the anti-war movement and violent opposition to the draft laws. He felt he had to make citizens understand why such laws were necessary. He prepared a speech which explained his thoughts. "There can be no army without men," Lincoln wrote. "Men can be had only with their permission or without it. We can no longer get enough men willingly. So there is a draft. If you dispute this and declare that men are still willing to serve in the army, then prove it by volunteering yourselves in large numbers. Then I will give up the draft."
Lincoln never gave this speech. He felt it was too direct. Instead, he gave a different kind of speech to the people of the Union. "You want peace," Lincoln said, "and you blame me that we do not have it. But how can we get it? There are but three ways possible. First, to put down the Southern rebellion by force of arms. This I am trying to do. Are you for it? If you are, then we are so far agreed. If you are not for it, a second way is to give up the Union. I am against this. Are you for the Union? If you are, you should say so clearly. If you are not for force and not for dissolving the Union, there only remains some kind of compromise. I do not believe any such compromise is possible."
Politicians urged President Lincoln to investigate the anti-war protests in New York to learn who had led them. He refused. Lincoln believed that starting an investigation would be like lighting a barrel of gunpowder. He already was fighting a bitter struggle against rebels in the South. He did not want to fight the people of the North, too. Southern leaders were pleased with the Copperheads' anti-war movement. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.